is gigantic. If you've used the internet basically at all over the past decade, then you've been a part of someone else's explore-exploit problem. Companies want to discover the things that make them the most money while simultaneously making as much of it as they can. Explore, exploit. Big tech firms such as Amazon and Google began carrying out live A/B tests on their users starting in about 2000. And over the following years, the internet has become the world's largest controlled experiment. What are these companies exploring and exploiting? In a word, you. Whatever it is that makes you move your mouse and open your wallet. Companies A/B test their site navigation, the subject lines and timing of their marketing emails, and sometimes even their actual features and pricing. Instead of the Google search algorithm and the Amazon checkout flow, there are now untold and unfathomably subtle permutations. Google infamously tested 41 shades of blue for one of its toolbars in 2009. In some cases, it's unlikely that any pair of users will have the exact same experience. Data scientist Jeff Hammerbacher, former manager of the data group at Facebook, once told Bloomberg Businessweek that the best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads. Consider it the millennials' howl, what Allen Ginsberg's immortal "I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness" was to the Beat Generation. Hammerbacher's take on the situation was that this state of affairs sucks. But regardless of what one makes of it, the web is allowing for an experimental science of the click, the likes of which had never even been dreamed of by marketers of the past. We know what happened to Obama in the 2008 election, of course. But what happened to his director of analytics, Dan Seroker? After the inauguration, Seroker returned west to California, and with fellow Googler Pete Kumin, co-founded the website optimization firm Optimizely. By the 2012 presidential election cycle, their company counted among its clients both the Obama re-election campaign and the campaign of Republican challenger Mitt Romney. Within a decade or so after its first tentative use, A/B testing was no longer a secret weapon. It has become such a deeply embedded part of how business and politics are conducted online as to be effectively taken for granted. The next time you open your browser, you can be sure that the colors, images, text, perhaps even the prices you see, and certainly the ads, have come from an explore-exploit algorithm, tuning itself to your clicks. In this particular multi-armed bandit problem, you're not the gambler. You're the jackpot. The process of A/B testing itself has become increasingly refined over time. The most canonical A/B setup, splitting the traffic evenly between two options, running the test for a set period of time, and thereafter giving all the traffic to the winner, might not necessarily be the best algorithm for solving the problem, since it means half the users are stuck getting the inferior option as the test continues. And the rewards for finding a better approach are potentially very high. More than 90% of Google's approximately $50 billion in annual revenue currently comes from paid advertising, and online commerce comprises hundreds of billions of dollars a year. This means that explore-exploit algorithms effectively power, both economically and technologically, a significant fraction of the internet itself. The best algorithms to use remain hotly contested, with rival statisticians, engineers, and bloggers endlessly sparring about the optimal way to balance exploration and exploitation in every possible business scenario. Debating the precise distinctions among various takes on the explore-exploit problem may seem hopelessly arcane. In fact, these distinctions turn out to matter immensely. And it's not just presidential elections and the internet economy that are at stake. It's also human lives. Clinical trials on trial. Between 1932 and 1972, several hundred African-American men with syphilis in Macon County, Alabama, went deliberately untreated by medical professionals, as part of a 40-year experiment by the U.S. Public Health Service, known as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. In 1966, Public Health Service employee Peter Buxton filed a protest. He filed a second protest in 1968. But it was not until he broke the story to the press. It appeared in the Washington Star on July 25, 1972, and was the front page story in the New York Times the next day, that the U.S. government finally halted the study. What followed the public outcry and the subsequent congressional hearing was an initiative to formalize the principles and standards of medical ethics. A commission held at the Pastoral Belmont Conference Center in Maryland resulted in a 1979 document known as the Belmont Report. The Belmont Report lays out a foundation for the ethical practice of medical experiments, so that the Tuskegee experiment, an egregious, unambiguously inappropriate breach of the health profession's duty to its patients, might never be repeated. But it also notes the difficulty in many other cases of determining exactly where the line should be drawn. The Hippocratic maxim, do no harm, has long been a fundamental principle of medical ethics, the report points out. The physiologist Claude Bernard extended it to the realm of research, saying that one should not injure one person, regardless of the benefits that might come to others. However, even avoiding harm requires learning what is harmful. And in the process of obtaining this information, persons may be exposed to risk of harm. The Belmont Report thus acknowledges, but does not resolve, the tension that exists between acting on one's best knowledge and gathering more. It also makes it clear that gathering knowledge can be so valuable that some aspects of normal medical ethics can be suspended. Clinical testing of new drugs and treatments, the report notes, often requires risking harm to some patients, even if steps are taken to minimize that risk. The principle of beneficence is not always so unambiguous. A difficult ethical problem remains, for example, about research on childhood diseases that presents more than minimal risk without immediate prospect of direct benefit to the children involved. Some have argued that such research is inadmissible, while others have pointed out that this limit would rule out much research promising great benefit to children in the future. Here again, as with all hard cases, the different claims covered by the principle of beneficence may come into conflict and force difficult choices. One of the fundamental questions that has arisen in the decades since the Belmont Report is whether the standard approach to conducting clinical trials really does minimize risk to patients. In a conventional clinical trial, patients are split into groups, and each group is assigned to receive a different treatment for the duration of the study. Only in exceptional cases does a trial get stopped early. This procedure focuses on decisively resolving the question of which treatment is better, rather than on providing the best treatment to each patient in the trial itself. In this way, it operates exactly like a website's A/B test, with a certain fraction of people receiving an experience during the experiment that will eventually be proven inferior. But doctors, like tech companies, are gaining some information about which option is better while the trial proceeds. Information that could be used to improve outcomes not only for future patients beyond the trial, but for the patients currently in it. Millions of dollars are at stake in experiments to find the optimal configuration of a website, but in clinical trials, experimenting to find optimal treatments has direct life or death consequences. And a growing community of doctors and statisticians think that we're doing it wrong, that we should be treating the selection of treatments as a multi-armed bandit problem, and trying to get the better treatments to people even while an experiment is in progress. In 1969, Marvin Zellin, a biostatistician who is now at Harvard, proposed conducting adaptive trials. One of the ideas he suggested was a randomized play-the-winner algorithm, a version of win-stay-lose-shift, in which the chance of using a given treatment is increased by each win and decreased by each loss. In Zellin's procedure, you start with a hat that contains one ball for each of the two treatment options being studied. The treatment for the first patient is selected by drawing a ball at random from the hat. The ball is put back afterward. If the chosen treatment is a success, you put another ball for that treatment into the hat. Now you have three balls, two of which are for the successful treatment. If it fails, then you put another ball for the other treatment into the hat, making it more likely you'll choose the alternative. Zelin's algorithm was first used in a clinical trial 16 years later for a study of extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, an audacious approach to treating respiratory failure in infants. Developed in the 1970s by Robert Bartlett of the University of Michigan, ECMO takes blood that's heading for the lungs and routes it instead out of the body, where it's oxygenated by a machine and returned to the heart. It is a drastic measure with risks of its own, including the possibility of embolism, but it offered a possible approach in situations where no other options remained. In 1975, ECMO saved the life of a newborn girl in Orange County, California, for whom even a ventilator was not providing enough oxygen. That girl has now celebrated her 40th birthday and is married with children of her own. But in its early days, the ECMO technology and procedure were considered highly experimental, and early studies in adults showed no benefit compared to conventional treatments. From 1982 to 1984, Bartlett and his colleagues at the University of Michigan performed a study on newborns with respiratory failure. The team was clear that they wanted to address, as they put it, the ethical issue of withholding an unproven but potentially life-saving treatment, and were reluctant to withhold a life-saving treatment from alternate patients simply to meet conventional random assignment technique. Hence, they turned to Zelin's algorithm. The strategy resulted in one infant being assigned the conventional treatment and dying, and 11 infants in a row being assigned the experimental ECMO treatment, all of them surviving. Between April and November of 1984, after the end of the official study, 10 additional infants met the criteria for ECMO treatment. 8 were treated with ECMO, and all 8 survived. 2 were treated conventionally, and both died. These are eye-catching numbers, yet shortly after the University of Michigan study on ECMO was completed, it became mired in controversy. Having so few patients in a trial receive the conventional treatment deviated significantly from standard methodology, and the procedure itself was highly invasive and potentially risky. After the publication of the paper, Jim Ware, professor of biostatistics at the Harvard School of Public Health, and his medical colleagues examined the data carefully and concluded that they did not justify routine use of ECMO without further study. So Ware and his colleagues designed a second clinical trial, still trying to balance the acquisition of knowledge with the effective treatment of patients, but using a less radical design. They would randomly assign patients to either ECMO or the conventional treatment until a pre-specified number of deaths was observed in one of the groups. Then they would switch all of the patients in the study to the more effective treatment of the two. In the first phase of Ware's study, 4 of 10 infants receiving conventional treatment died, and all 9 of 9 infants receiving ECMO survived. The 4 deaths were enough to trigger a transition to the second phase, where all 20 patients were treated with ECMO, and 19 survived. Ware and colleagues were convinced, concluding that it is difficult to defend further randomization ethically. But some had already concluded this before the Ware study, and were vocal about it. The critics included Don Barry, one of the world's leading experts on multi-armed bandits. In a comment that was published alongside the Ware study in Statistical Science, Barry wrote that randomizing patients to non-ECMO therapy, as in the Ware study, was unethical. In my view, the Ware study should not have been conducted. And yet, even the Ware study was not conclusive for all in the medical community. In the 1990s, yet another study on ECMO was conducted, enrolling nearly 200 infants in the United Kingdom. Instead of using adaptive algorithms, this study followed the traditional methods, splitting the infants randomly into 2 equal groups. The researchers justified the experiment by saying that ECMO's usefulness is controversial because of varying interpretation of the available evidence. As it turned out, the difference between the treatments wasn't as pronounced in the United Kingdom as it had been in the two American studies. But the results were nonetheless declared in accord with the earlier preliminary findings that a policy of ECMO support reduces the risk of death. The cost of that knowledge? 24 more infants died in the conventional group than in the group receiving ECMO treatment. The widespread difficulty with accepting results from adaptive clinical trials might seem incomprehensible. But consider that part of what the advent of statistics did for medicine at the start of the 20th century was to transform it from a field in which doctors had to persuade each other in ad hoc ways about every new treatment into one where they had clear guidelines about what sorts of evidence were and were not persuasive. Changes to accepted standard statistical practice have the potential to upset this balance, at least temporarily. After the controversy over ECMO, Don Barry moved from the statistics department at the University of Minnesota to the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, where he has used methods developed by studying multi-armed bandits to design clinical trials for a variety of cancer treatments. While he remains one of the more vocal critics of randomized clinical trials, he is by no means the only one. In recent years, the ideas he's been fighting for are finally beginning to come into the mainstream. In February 2010, the FDA released a guidance document, Adaptive Design Clinical Trials for Drugs and Biologics, which suggests, despite a long history of sticking to an option they trust, that they might at last be willing to explore alternatives.
The Restless World. Once you become familiar with them, it's easy to see multi-armed bandits just about everywhere we turn. It's rare that we make an isolated decision where the outcome doesn't provide us with any information that we'll use to make other decisions in the future. So it's natural to ask, as we did with optimal stopping, how well people generally tend to solve these problems, a question that has been extensively explored in the laboratory by psychologists and behavioral economists. In general, it seems that people tend to over-explore, to favor the new disproportionately over the best. In a simple demonstration of this phenomenon published in 1966, Amos Tversky and Ward Edwards conducted experiments where people were shown a box with two lights on it and told that each light would turn on a fixed but unknown percentage of the time. They were then given 1,000 opportunities either to observe which light came on or to place a bet on the outcome without getting to observe it. Unlike a more traditional bandit problem setup, here one could not make a pull that was both wager and observation at once. Participants would not learn whether their bets had paid off until the end. This is pure exploration versus exploitation, pitting the gaining of information squarely against the use of it. For the most part, people adopted a sensible strategy of observing for a while, then placing bets on what seemed like the best outcome. But they consistently spent a lot more time observing than they should have. How much more time? In one experiment, one light came on 60% of the time, and the other 40% of the time. A difference neither particularly blatant nor particularly subtle. In that case, people chose to observe 505 times on average, placing bets the other 495 times. But the math says they should have started to bet after just 38 observations, leaving 962 chances to cash in. Other studies have produced similar conclusions. In the 1990s, Robert Meyer and Yang Shi, researchers at Wharton, ran a study where people were given a choice between two options, one with a known payoff chance and one unknown. Specifically, two airlines, an established carrier with a known on-time rate, and a new company without a track record yet. Given the goal of maximizing the number of on-time arrivals over some period of time, the mathematically optimal strategy is to initially only fly the new airline, as long as the established one isn't clearly better. If at any point it's apparent that the well-known carrier is better, that is, if the Gittins index of the new option falls below the on-time rate of the familiar carrier, then you should switch hard to the familiar one and never look back. Since in this setup you can't get any more information about the new company once you stop flying it, there is no opportunity for it to redeem itself. But in the experiment, people tended to use the untried airline too little when it was good and too much when it was bad. They also didn't make clean breaks away from it, often continuing to alternate, particularly when neither airline was departing on time. All of this is consistent with tending to overexplore. Finally, psychologists Mark Stivers, Michael Lee, and E.J. Wagonmakers have run an experiment with a four-armed bandit, asking a group of people to choose which arm to play over a sequence of 15 opportunities. They then classified the strategies that participants seemed to use. The results suggested that 30% were closest to the optimal strategy, 47% most resembled win stay, lose shift, and 22% seemed to move at random between selecting a new arm and playing the best arm found so far. Again, this is consistent with overexploring, as win stay, lose shift, and occasionally trying an arm at random are both going to lead people to try things other than the best option late in the game, when they should be purely exploiting. So while we tend to commit to a new secretary too soon, it seems like we tend to stop trying new airlines too late. But just as there's a cost to not having a secretary, there's a cost to committing too soon to a particular airline. The world might change. The standard multi-armed bandit problem assumes that the probabilities with which the arms pay off are fixed over time. But that's not necessarily true of airlines, restaurants, or other contexts in which people have to make repeated choices. If the probabilities of a payoff on the different arms change over time, what has been termed a restless bandit, the problem becomes much harder. So much harder, in fact, that there's no tractable algorithm for completely solving it, and it's believed there never will be. Part of this difficulty is that it is no longer simply a matter of exploring for a while and then exploiting. When the world can change, continuing to explore can be the right choice. It might be worth going back to that disappointing restaurant you haven't visited for a few years, just in case it's under new management. In his celebrated essay, Walking, Henry David Thoreau reflected on how he preferred to do his traveling close to home, how he never tired of his surroundings and always found something new or surprising in the Massachusetts landscape. There is, in fact, a sort of harmony discoverable between the capabilities of the landscape within a circle of 10 miles radius, or the limits of an afternoon walk, and the 70 years of human life, he wrote. It will never become quite familiar to you. To live in a restless world requires a certain restlessness in oneself. So long as things continue to change, you must never fully cease exploring. Still, the algorithmic techniques honed for this standard version of the multi-armed bandit problem are useful even in a restless world. Strategies like the Gittins Index and Upper Confidence Bound provide reasonably good approximate solutions and rules of thumb, particularly if payoffs don't change very much over time. And many of the world's payoffs are arguably more static today than they've ever been. A berry patch might be ripe 1 week and rotten the next, but as Andy Warhol put it, a Coke is a Coke. Having instincts tuned by evolution for a world in constant flux isn't necessarily helpful in an era of industrial standardization. Perhaps most importantly, thinking about versions of the multi-armed bandit problem that do have optimal solutions doesn't just offer algorithms. It also offers insights. The conceptual vocabulary derived from the classical form of the problem, the tension of explore-exploit, the importance of the interval, the high value of the 0-0 option, the minimization of regret, gives us a new way of making sense not only of specific problems that come before us, but of the entire arc of human life. Explore. While laboratory studies can be illuminating, the interval of many of the most important problems people face is far too long to be studied in the lab. Learning the structure of the world around us and forming lasting social relationships are both lifelong tasks. So it's instructive to see how the general pattern of early exploration and late exploitation appears over the course of a lifetime. One of the curious things about human beings, which any developmental psychologist aspires to understand and explain, is that we take years to become competent and autonomous. Caribou and gazelles must be prepared to run from predators the day they're born, but humans take more than a year to make their first steps. Alison Gopnik, professor of developmental psychology at UC Berkeley and author of The Scientist in the Crib, has an explanation for why human beings have such an extended period of dependence. It gives you a developmental way of solving the exploration-exploitation trade-off. As we have seen, good algorithms for playing multi-armed bandits tend to explore more early on, exploiting the resulting knowledge later. But as Gopnik points out, the disadvantage of that is that you don't get good payoffs when you're in the exploration stage. Hence, childhood. Childhood gives you a period in which you can just explore possibilities, and you don't have to worry about payoffs, because payoffs are being taken care of by the mamas and the papas and the grandmas and the babysitters. Thinking about children as simply being at the transitory exploration stage of a lifelong algorithm might provide some solace for parents of preschoolers. Tom has two highly exploratory preschool-age daughters and hopes they are following an algorithm that has minimal regret. But it also provides new insights about the rationality of children. Gopnik points out that if you look at the history of the way people have thought about children, they have typically argued that children are cognitively deficient in various ways. Because if you look at their exploit capacities, they look terrible. They can't tie their shoes, they're not good at long-term planning, they're not good at focused attention. Those are all things that kids are really awful at. But pressing buttons at random, being very interested in new toys, and jumping quickly from one thing to another are all things that kids are really great at. And those are exactly what they should be doing if their goal is exploration. If you're a baby, putting every object in the house into your mouth is like studiously pulling all the handles at the casino. More generally, our intuitions about rationality are too often informed by exploitation rather than exploration. When we talk about decision-making, we usually focus just on the immediate payoff of a single decision. And if you treat every decision as if it were your last, then indeed only exploitation makes sense. But over a lifetime, you're going to make a lot of decisions, and it's actually rational to emphasize exploration, the new rather than the best, the exciting rather than the safe, the random rather than the considered, for many of those choices, particularly earlier in life. What we take to be the caprice of children may be wiser than we know. And exploit. I had reached a juncture in my reading life that is familiar to those who have been there. In the allotted time left to me on Earth, should I read more and more new books, or should I cease with that vain consumption, vain because it is endless, and begin to reread those books that had given me the intensest pleasure in my past? Lydia Davis. At the other extreme from toddlers, we have the elderly. And thinking about aging from the perspective of the explore-exploit dilemma also provides some surprising insights into how we should expect our lives to change as time goes on. Laura Carstensen, a professor of psychology at Stanford, has spent her career challenging our preconceptions about getting older. Particularly, she has investigated exactly how and why people's social relationships change as they age. The basic pattern is clear. The size of people's social networks, that is, the number of social relationships they engage in, almost invariably decreases over time. But Carstensen's research has transformed how we should think about this phenomenon. The traditional explanation for the elderly having smaller social networks is that it's just one example of the decrease in quality of life that comes with aging, the result of diminished ability to contribute to social relationships, greater fragility, and general disengagement from society. But Carstensen has argued that, in fact, the elderly have fewer social relationships by choice. As she puts it, these decreases are the result of lifelong selection processes by which people strategically and adaptively cultivate their social networks to maximize social and emotional gains and minimize social and emotional risks. What Carstensen and her colleagues found is that the shrinking of social networks with aging is due primarily to pruning peripheral relationships and focusing attention instead on a core of close friends and family members. This process seems to be a deliberate choice. As people approach the end of their lives, they want to focus more on the connections that are the most meaningful. In an experiment testing this hypothesis, Carstensen and her collaborator Barbara Fredrickson asked people to choose who they'd rather spend 30 minutes with. An immediate family member? The author of a book they'd recently read? Or somebody they had met recently who seemed to share their interests? Older people preferred the family member. Young people were just as excited to meet the author or make a new friend. But in a critical twist, if the young people were asked to imagine that they were about to move across the country, they preferred the family member too. In another study, Carstensen and her colleagues found the same result in the other direction as well. If older people were asked to imagine that a medical breakthrough would allow them to live 20 years longer, their preferences became indistinguishable from those of young people. The point is that these differences in social preference are not about age as such. They're about where people perceive themselves to be on the interval relevant to their decision. Being sensitive to how much time you have left is exactly what the computer science of the explore-exploit dilemma suggests. We think of the young as stereotypically fickle, the old stereotypically set in their ways. In fact, both are behaving completely appropriately with respect to their intervals. The deliberate honing of a social network down to the most meaningful relationships is the rational response to having less time to enjoy them. Recognizing that old age is a time of exploitation helps provide new perspectives on the classic phenomena of aging. For example, while going to college, a new social environment filled with people you haven't met is typically a positive, exciting time. Going to a retirement home, a new social environment filled with people you haven't met, can be painful. And that difference is partly the result of where we are on the explore-exploit continuum at those stages of our lives. The explore-exploit trade-off also tells us how to think about advice from our elders. When your grandfather tells you which restaurants are good, you should listen. Those are pearls gleaned from decades of searching. But when he only goes to the same restaurant at 5 p.m. every day, you should feel free to explore other options, even though they'll likely be worse. Perhaps the deepest insight that comes from thinking about later life as a chance to exploit knowledge acquired over decades is this: life should get better over time. What an explorer trades off for knowledge is pleasure. The Gittins Index and the upper confidence bound, as we've seen, inflate the appeal of lesser-known options beyond what we actually expect, since pleasant surprises can pay off many times over. But at the same time, this means that exploration necessarily leads to being let down on most occasions. Shifting the bulk of one's attention to one's favorite things should increase quality of life. And it seems like it does. Carstensen has found that older people are generally more satisfied with their social networks and often report levels of emotional well-being that are higher than those of younger adults. So there's a lot to look forward to, in being that late afternoon restaurant regular, savoring the fruits of a life's explorations. 3. Sorting, making order. Now if the word which thou art desirous to find begin with A, then look in the beginning of this table, but if with V, look towards the end. Again, if thy word begin with CA, look in the beginning of the letter C, but if with CU, then look toward the end of that letter. And so all of the rest, etc. Robert Caudry, A Table Alphabetical, 1604. Before Danny Hillis founded the Thinking Machines Corporation, before he invented the famous connection machine parallel supercomputer, he was an MIT undergraduate, living in the student dormitory and horrified by his roommate's socks. What horrified Hillis, unlike many a college undergraduate, wasn't the roommate's hygiene. It wasn't that the roommate didn't wash the socks. He did. The problem was what came next. The roommate pulled a sock out of the clean laundry hamper. Next, he pulled another sock out at random. If it didn't match the first one, he tossed it back in. Then he continued this process, pulling out socks one by one and tossing them back, until he found a match for the first. With just 10 different pairs of socks, following this method will take on average 19 pulls merely to complete the first pair, and 17 more pulls to complete the second. In total, the roommate can expect to go fishing in the hamper 110 times, just to pair 20 socks. It was enough to make any budding computer scientist request a room transfer. Now, just how socks should be sorted is a good way to get computer scientists talking at surprising length. A question about socks posted to the programming website Stack Overflow in 2013 prompted some 12,000 words of debate. "Socks confound me," confessed legendary cryptographer and Turing Award-winning computer scientist Ron Rivest to the two of us when we brought up the topic. He was wearing sandals at the time. The ecstasy of sorting. Sorting is at the very heart of what computers do. In fact, in many ways, it was sorting that brought the computer into being. In the late 19th century, the American population was growing by 30% every decade, and the number of subjects of inquiry in the U.S. Census had gone from just 5 in 1870 to more than 200 in 1880. The tabulation of the 1880 census took 8 years, just barely finishing by the time the 1890 census began. As a writer at the time put it, it was a wonder the clerks who toiled at the irritating slips of tally paper did not go blind and crazy. The whole enterprise was threatening to collapse under its own weight. Something had to be done. Inspired by the punched railway tickets of the time, an inventor by the name of Herman Hollerith devised a system of punched manila cards to store information, and a machine, which he called the Hollerith machine, to count and sort them. Hollerith was awarded a patent in 1889, and the government adopted the Hollerith machine for the 1890 census. No one had ever seen anything like it. Wrote one awestruck observer, "The apparatus works as unerringly as the mills of the gods, but beats them hollow as to speed." Another, however, reasoned that the invention was of limited use. As no one will ever use it but governments, the inventor will not likely get very rich. This prediction, which Hollerith clipped and saved, would not prove entirely correct. Hollerith's firm merged with several others in 1911 to become the Computing Tabulating Recording Company. A few years later, it was renamed to International Business Machines, or IBM. Sorting continued to spur the development of the computer through the next century. The first code ever written for a stored program computer was a program for efficient sorting. In fact, it was the computer's ability to outsort IBM's dedicated card sorting machines that convinced the U.S. government their enormous financial investment in a general-purpose machine was justified. By the 1960s, one study estimated that more than a quarter of the computing resources of the world were being spent on sorting. And no wonder. Sorting is essential to working with almost any kind of information. Whether it's finding the largest or the smallest, the most common or the rarest, tallying, indexing, flagging duplicates, or just plain looking for the thing you want, they all generally begin under the hood with a sort. But sorting is more pervasive even than this. After all, one of the main reasons things get sorted is to be shown in useful form to human eyes, which means that sorting is also key to the human experience of information. Sorted lists are so ubiquitous that, like the fish who asks, "What is water?" we must consciously work to perceive them at all. And then we perceive them everywhere. Our email inbox typically displays the top 50 messages of potentially thousands, sorted by time of receipt. When we look for restaurants on Yelp, we're shown the top dozen or so of hundreds, sorted by proximity or by rating. A blog shows a cropped list of articles sorted by date. The Facebook newsfeed, Twitter stream, and Reddit homepage all present themselves as lists sorted by some proprietary measure. We refer to things like Google and Bing as search engines, but that is something of a misnomer. They're really sort engines. What makes Google so dominant as a means of accessing the world's information is less that it finds our text within hundreds of millions of web pages. Its 1990s competitors could generally do that part well enough, but that it sorts those web pages so well and only shows us the most relevant 10. The truncated top of an immense sorted list is, in many ways, the universal user interface. Computer science gives us a way to understand what's going on behind the scenes in all of these cases, which in turn can offer us some insight for those times when we are the ones stuck making order. With our bills, our papers, our books, our socks, probably more times each day than we realize. By quantifying the vice and the virtue of mess, it also shows us the cases where we actually shouldn't make order at all. What's more, when we begin looking, we see that sorting isn't just something we do with information. It's something we do with people. Perhaps the place where the computer science of establishing rank is most unexpectedly useful is on the sporting field and in the boxing ring, which is why knowing a little about sorting might help explain how human beings are able to live together while only occasionally coming to blows. That is to say, sorting offers some surprising clues about the nature of society, that other, larger, and more important kind of order that we make. The agony of sorting. To lower costs per unit of output, people usually increase the size of their operations, wrote J.C. Hoskin in 1955 in the first scientific article published on sorting. This is the economy of scale familiar to any business student. But with sorting, size is a recipe for disaster. Perversely, as a sort grows larger, the unit cost of sorting, instead of falling, rises. Sorting involves steep diseconomies of scale, violating our normal intuitions about the virtues of doing things in bulk. Cooking for two is typically no harder than cooking for one, and it's certainly easier than cooking for one person twice. But sorting, say, a shelf of 100 books will take you longer than sorting two bookshelves of 50 apiece. You have twice as many things to organize, and there are twice as many places each of them could go. The more you take on, the worse it gets. This is the first
and most fundamental insight of sorting theory. Scale hurts. From this, we might infer that minimizing our pain and suffering when it comes to sorting is all about minimizing the number of things we have to sort. It's true. One of the best preventatives against the computational difficulty of sock sorting is just doing your laundry more often. Doing laundry three times as frequently, say, could reduce your sorting overhead by a factor of 9. Indeed, if Hillis's roommate stuck with his peculiar procedure but went 13 days between washes instead of 14, that alone would save him 28 pulls from the hamper. And going just a single day longer between washes would cost him 30 pulls more. Even at such a modest fortnightly scope, we can see the scale of sorting beginning to grow untenable. Computers, though, must routinely sort millions of items in a single go. For that, as the line from Jaws puts it, we're going to need a bigger boat and a better algorithm. But to answer the question of just how we ought to be sorting and which methods come out on top, we need to figure out something else first: how we're going to keep score. Big O, a yardstick for the worst case. The Guinness Book of World Records attributes the record for sorting a deck of cards to the Czech magician Zdeněk Bradáš. On May 15, 2008, Bradáš sorted a 52-card deck in just 36.16 seconds. How did he do it? What sorting technique delivered him the title? Though the answer would shed interesting light on sorting theory, Bradáš declined to comment. While we have nothing but respect for Bradáš's skill and dexterity, we are 100% certain of the following. We can personally break his record. In fact, we are 100% certain that we can attain an unbreakable record. All we need are about 80 unvigintillion attempts at the title. This number, 80 followed by 66 zeros, is 52 factorial, or the number of ways that a deck of 52 cards can possibly be ordered. By taking roughly that many attempts, sooner or later, we are bound to start with a shuffled deck that is, in fact, completely sorted by chance. At that point, we can proudly enter Christian Griffiths into the Guinness Book, alongside a not-too-shabby sort time of 0 minutes, 0 seconds. To be fair, we'd almost certainly be trying until the heat death of the universe before we got our perfect record attempt. Nonetheless, this highlights the biggest fundamental difference between record keepers and computer scientists. The fine folks at Guinness care only about best-case performance and beer. They're hardly blameworthy, of course. All records in sports reflect the single best performance. Computer science, however, almost never cares about the best case. Instead, computer scientists might want to know the average sort time of someone like Bradáš. Get him to sort all of the 80 unvigintillion deck orders, or a reasonably sized sample, and score him on his average speed across all attempts. You can see why they don't let computer scientists run these things. Moreover, a computer scientist would want to know the worst sort time. Worst case analysis lets us make hard guarantees: that a critical process will finish in time, that deadlines won't be blown. So for the rest of this chapter, and the rest of this audiobook actually, we will be discussing only algorithms' worst-case performance, unless noted otherwise. Computer science has developed a shorthand specifically for measuring algorithmic worst-case scenarios. It's called Big O notation. Big O notation has a particular quirk, which is that it's inexact by design. That is, rather than expressing an algorithm's performance in minutes and seconds, Big O notation provides a way to talk about the kind of relationship
that holds between the size of the problem and the program's running time. Because Big O notation deliberately sheds fine details, what emerges is a schema for dividing problems into different broad classes. Imagine you're hosting a dinner party with N guests. The time required to clean the house for their arrival doesn't depend on the number of guests at all. This is the rosiest class of problems there is, called Big O of One. It is also known as constant time. Notably, Big O notation doesn't care a whit how long the cleaning actually takes, just that it's always the same, totally invariant of the guest list. You've got the same work to do if you have one guest as if you have 10, 100, or any other N. Now, the time required to pass the roast around the table will be Big O of N, also known as linear time. With twice the guests, you'll wait twice as long for the dish to come around. And again, Big O notation couldn't care less about the number of courses that get served or whether they go around for second helpings. In each case, the time still depends linearly on the guest list size. If you drew a graph of the number of guests versus the time taken, it would be a straight line. What's more, the existence of any linear time factors will, in Big O notation, swamp all constant time factors. That is to say, passing the roast once around the table, or remodeling your dining room for 3 months and then passing the roast once around the table, are both, to a computer scientist, effectively equivalent. If that seems crazy, remember that computers deal with values of N that could easily be in the thousands, millions, or billions. In other words, computer scientists are thinking about very, very big parties. With a guest list in the millions, passing the roast once around would indeed make the home remodel seem dwarfed to the point of insignificance. What if, as the guests arrived, each one hugged the others in greeting? Your first guest hugs you. Your second guest has two hugs to give. Your third guest, three. How many hugs will there be in total? This turns out to be Big O of N squared, and also known as quadratic time. Here again, we only care about the basic contours of the relationship between N and time. There's no Big O of 2N squared for two hugs apiece, or Big O of N squared plus N for hugs plus passing the food around, or Big O of N squared plus 1 for hugs plus home cleaning. It's all quadratic time. So Big O of N squared covers everything. It gets worse from there. There's exponential time, Big O of 2 to the N, where each additional guest doubles your work. Even worse is factorial time, Big O of N factorial, a class of problems so truly hellish that computer scientists only talk about it when they're joking, as we were in imagining shuffling a deck until it's sorted, or when they really, really wish they were. The squares, bubble sort and insertion sort. When then-Senator Obama visited Google in 2007, CEO Eric Schmidt jokingly began the Q&A like a job interview, asking him, "What's the best way to sort a million 32-bit integers?" Without missing a beat, Obama cracked a wry smile and replied, "I think the bubble sort would be the wrong way to go." The crowd of Google engineers erupted in cheers. "He had me at bubble sort," one later recalled. Obama was right to eschew bubble sort, an algorithm which has become something of a punching bag for computer science students. It's simple, it's intuitive, and it's extremely inefficient. Imagine you want to alphabetize your unsorted collection of books. A natural approach would just be to scan across the shelf looking for out-of-order pairs, Wallace followed by Pynchon, for instance, and flipping them around. Put Pynchon ahead of Wallace, then continue your scan, looping around to the beginning of the shelf each time you reach the end.
When you make a complete pass, without finding any more out-of-order pairs on the entire shelf, then you know the job is done. This is bubble sort, and it lands us in quadratic time. There are n books out of order, and each scan through the shelf can move each one, at most, one position. We spot a tiny problem, make a tiny fix. So in the worst case, where the shelf is perfectly backward, at least one book will need to be moved n positions. Thus, a maximum of n passes through n books, which gives us our big O of n squared quadratic time in the worst case. It's not terrible. For one thing, it's worlds better than our big O of n factorial shuffle till it's sorted idea from earlier, in case you needed computer science to confirm that. But all the same, that squared term can get daunting quickly. For instance, it means that sorting five shelves of books will take not five times as long as sorting a single shelf, but 25 times as long. You might take a different tack, pulling all the books off the shelf and putting them back in place one by one. You'd put the first book in the middle of the shelf, then take the second and compare it to the first, inserting it either to the right or to the left. Picking up the third book, you'd run through the books on the shelf from left to right until you found the right spot to tug it in. Repeating this process, gradually all of the books would end up sorted on the shelf and you'd be done. Computer scientists call this, appropriately enough, insertion sort. The good news is that it's arguably even more intuitive than bubble sort and doesn't have quite the bad reputation. The bad news is that it's not actually that much faster. You still have to do one insertion for each book, and each insertion still involves moving past about half the books on the shelf on average to find the correct place. Although in practice, insertion sort does run a bit faster than bubble sort. Again, we land squarely, if you will, in quadratic time. Sorting anything more than a single bookshelf is still an unwieldy prospect. Breaking the quadratic barrier, divide and conquer. At this point, having seen two entirely sensible approaches fall into unsustainable quadratic time, it's natural to wonder whether faster sorting is even possible. The question sounds like it's about productivity, but talk to a computer scientist and it turns out to be something closer to metaphysics, akin to thinking about the speed of light, time travel, superconductors, or thermodynamic entropy. What are the universe's fundamental rules and limits? What is possible? What is allowed? In this way, computer scientists are glimpsing God's blueprints every bit as much as the particle physicists and cosmologists. What is the minimum effort required to make order? Could we find a constant time sort, big O of one? One that, like cleaning the house before the bevy of guests arrive, can sort a list of any size in the same amount of time? Well, even just confirming that a shelf of N books is sorted cannot be done in constant time, since it requires checking all n of them. So actually, sorting the books in constant time seems out of the question. What about a linear time sort, big O of n? As efficient as passing a dish around a table, where doubling the number of items to sort merely doubles the work. Thinking about the previous examples, it's tough to imagine how that might work either.